Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hey, everybody. I'm so thrilled to be sitting in front of May Elise Cannon today. I made a note that we are recording this in mid-November, and we're both wearing these cute little almost matching cowl neck sweaters. And mine is because it was down to 50 overnight low here in Houston. And May, that's not really what it looks like where you live.
No, it's closer to, it was 30s last night. So.
And she's got a beautiful fire behind her, and I'm so thrilled. And we have prayed that the dogs that are in the room will just be calm and quiet while we're trying to record. May Elise Cannon has written this wonderful book that I just finished this morning called Beyond Hashtag Activism, Comprehensive Justice in a Complicated Age. And May is a pastor, and she helps with an organization called Churches for Middle East Peace. And her resume is just so impressive and so long that I said, May, could you do me the favor and please just kind of introduce yourself to our listeners so we know who we're listening to and who we're listening to today.
Thank you. Well, I wear a few hats. I'm the executive director of Churches for Middle East Peace. So my professional world right now focuses on peace building in the Middle East and religious diplomacy, working with 30 different denominations that are a part of that member communion. And, you know, on the other side, I'm an academic and a pastor. So I'm ordained in the Evangelical Covenant Church. My first call was into ministry at a time when I didn't even have a theology that allowed for women to be ministers. So I didn't know what that meant. Since then, I've become ordained in the Evangelical Covenant. And then the academic hat, I have chronic insomnia. And so what do I do when I can't sleep? I read and I write. And so my husband used to tease me. I had several master's degrees, and he used to tease me, instead of jack of all trades, master of none, he'd say master of all trades and doctorate of none. So I went and got a couple of those too.
Yes, I'm like looking and I'm like, oh my goodness, the initials behind your name are so fantastic. But I would say that while it is obvious that you read and you write, but you read and you write not just for your own edification, but for us. And so I want to say thank you, because after reading your most recent book, I just thought this is a great tool. This is something that it gave me an overview of a lot of different areas. I mean, you cover so much in this book. You cover issues of race and gender and poverty and sexuality and Middle East and religious freedom and politics and justice, kind of mixed in all of that, of course, through the framework, a biblical framework, through the gospel, which these topics can be so, I mean, number one, they're definitely complicated, they're complex, but they can also be very confusing for Christians. Because I think partially because the term justice or social justice has gotten mixed reviews, kind of a bad rap from people inside the church and outside of the church. And so it was so refreshing to get this, it's more than an overview, but to get an overview from a really biblical perspective. So I kind of want to start by, like, why did you write this? What was the genesis of this project for you?
Well, thank you. And my hope and prayer is that this would be a piece of bringing the good news of the gospel with context where we can learn what that means in our world today. And so my hope and prayer is that it would serve others. I don't often have a lot of confidence, you know, in its efficacy in that regard. So it encourages me to hear your words. So thank you. I wrote this book I often say this book was the cry of my soul, particularly for our country at this moment in history. And my first book was Social Justice Handbook, and I love the subtitle of it. It was called Small Steps for a Better World. That was really what I wish, you know, I was a young pastor working in justice ministries, working with people who are homeless and people who are suffering from poverty. And that book was what I wish people had given me at that moment at the beginning of my ministry. And this book was actually a lot of issues that I'd never really studied theologically. And I mean, I didn't want to touch sexuality with a 100-foot pole. And I want to love people and love Jesus. And, you know, just felt like some of the challenges of, you know, what it means to study the scripture and also to love people when people have such strong ideas about what's right and wrong, it gets really, really messy. And so this book is kind of the manifestation of all of that mess of trying to dig deeply into a lot of those hard issues.
And this book is I had mentioned earlier that when we were chatting, I had the opportunity to talk with Brenda Salter McNeil last week, and she wrote one of the endorsements for your book. But one of the things that she and I chatted about is a conversation that I keep having with authors this year. I keep having with authors in 2020, which is, I know a smidge about the publishing world, and that is that you did not start this book. This wasn't your project after the pandemic started, right? This was something that obviously was started in the years prior to its release, but its release is so incredibly timely. I mean, its release is so incredibly timely. So, I mean, like, what do you make of this? I feel like, especially as we've been home during this pandemic, I'm probably not alone on this. I've spent more time on my phone than like ever before in my life. We can't keep up with the hashtags, right? In America, we are grief stricken about the people's names who have become hashtags. And in addition to that, there are the movements that are hashtags. And it feels overwhelming, like we can't keep up. And it doesn't matter how much time I spend on my phone, I feel like I'll never be caught up on what is happening. And so how does your book speak to that? And now that it's come out in 2020, how would you help people wrestle with that phenomenon that's happening?
Mm-hmm. So the thought and the impetus for this book happened for me in December of 2018. And then I wrote this book within a few short weeks. So, I mean, it was kind of written by early 2019. And then, as you mentioned, it, you know, wasn't published until May 2020. So it took, you know, all of that time. But some of what was happening that compelled me to write the book were things that have been going on in our country, not only for decades, but for centuries. And they've had different manifestations at different periods of time. So I would point to the story of the young man named Trayvon Martin, who, you know, I think it was 2014, in terms of the year that he was killed in Florida. He was not killed by a police officer, but he was killed by a gentleman who carried a gun. And he was brutally murdered after, you know, going to 7-Eleven. And, you know, he, I think, had a bag of candy, you know, and a pop on him kind of thing. And the story of Trayvon Martin really rocked the country in terms of racial injustice and the permissiveness of young Black boys being able to lose their lives. So one of the chapters I write about is I tell a lot of the stories of the names that you're talking about. And this was before George Floyd. So this year in 2020, with the death of George Floyd and then Breonna Taylor and, you know, the young man who was killed when he was out on a run, Ahmaud Arbery, right? You know, those names are not mentioned in this book. And then but what I do feel like each of these chapters looks at is, what are the systemic issues that allow for more and more names? And so part of why we can't keep up, as you were talking about that, is because of the systemic nature of racial injustice and the systemic nature of a lot of the concerns that this book is trying to address.
What was it that struck you Was there something particular, I guess, that struck you in December of 2018 when you just said, I've got to figure this out. I've got to write this down and talk about this.
It seems to me, in terms of the politics of the United States, you know, there's always been, in large part, this two-party system. But certainly in my lifetime, our country has never been more divided on politics than I've witnessed, you know, today. And then, you know, and particularly under the Trump presidency. And I think for me, what broke my heart was how differently people from different perspectives not only see things, but really seem to miss each other, you know, and I would put myself in that category. I believe in the word of the Bible, the Holy Scriptures. You know, I'm an evangelical. Now, I'm a woman, so a lot of conservative evangelicals would say she can't really be evangelical because she's a pastor, right? But I consider myself, in terms of a lot of political issues, like you know, fiscal conservatism, which I'm not using the term. I literally mean that I don't think, you know, a lot of money being put in the government is the best stewardship, but I think that the poor should have access to food. So I believe all these things. Whereas when I'm with a lot of my justice-oriented friends, you know, they are much more left than I from political perspectives. Whereas when you are with people who are Republican, which is my family background, I mean, I grew up in a very conservative Republican home. It's almost like liberals, you know, are evil. And when you're with people who have more left perspectives, it's almost like when you're with conservatives, they're evil. And that's just not how I find people to be. And it's not how I view the world. And so that division, where more people are getting married across religious divides than political divides, is part of why I wrote this book, to say, let's really look at what's, you know, and forgive me, I'm doing air quotes that no one can see, but, you know, let's really look at what a conservative perspective of this issue is. Let's look at what a more progressive perspective of this issue is, and let's sort it out. What's the Bible have to say about it? What's the history of it? And more than that, it's a problem. So how can we come together across these divides to try to address it?
I actually read that part aloud to my husband from your book, that this stat, this idea that more people will marry within their political persuasion, right? Like than necessarily their religion. And I'm like, wait, what? Like you said, well, most people will cross the religious divide more often than they will cross the political divide to marry. And I was just like, this is crazy. I was equally shocked, I think, when I was reading in David Swanson's book, Rediscipling the White Church, and he kind of has a similar perspective, right, of saying that white people have more in common with other white people than they do with Christians. Like white Christians have more in common with other white people than they do Christians of color, right? And it's just like all of these things where we're going, whoa, like we're supposed to be the family of God. This is what is supposed to unite us above all things, more than race, more than political persuasion, more than our perspectives on all of these other things, are supposed to be our relationship with Jesus and our relationship with each other. And we don't have to go there, right? But Jesus talks about that, right? This is how everyone else in the whole entire world is going to know what this whole thing is about, is because you guys are going to do such a great job of building each other. My paraphrase, obviously. But I think that you're right. It's just like this, these different perspectives. I'm wondering if we can shift, if you were going to say something else, go there. But if not, I'm wondering if you can take us to some of the work that Churches for Middle East Peace does, specifically this multi-narrative tour that you guys do in the Middle East and in Israel, because I feel like that is almost that experience, or what I feel like could be benefited from that experience, is kind of a microcosm for what could happen if we started looking at our neighbors in similar ways, the neighbors who we don't see eye to eye with. So tell us about that work, and how does that relate to how we can interact with one another?
Sure. Well, and I think part of what we were just talking about, the problem is that we don't have proximity with people with whom we disagree. And so which speaks to, you know, your very question about the Middle East. Let's talk about Israel and let's talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a significant example where most American Christians have access to one narrative and not the other. And I would say it's also not monolithic. It's not really a dual narrative situation. There's multiple narratives. You know, most people don't know, for example, that the state of Israel has about 8 million people, most of whom are Jewish, but 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinian citizens of Israel. So when you say Israeli, it doesn't necessarily mean an Israeli Jew. It could be an Israeli Palestinian, right? I mean, that's just one example of the multi-narrative approach. And so my work at Churches for Middle East Peace focuses on peace building in the broader Middle East, but one of the core issues we focus on is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And our approach is that if you truly care for any side of the conflict, you can never work constructively towards peace until you understand the other. If you really love the nation state of Israel, Israel as a nation state and the Jewish people of Israel, that 80% I was just talking about, they will not have a prosperous future unless injustices towards Palestinians are addressed and unless the Palestinian narrative is understood. And if you truly love the Palestinians and want for them to have freedom, Palestinians will never have freedom and never have liberty unless you understand the legitimate needs of their Jewish neighbors. You know, and I think that's really a very, very different way than most Americans look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah, for sure. Because I feel like now we could go a whole lot of other places with this, I think. But I think because of the influence of Christian evangelicalism in the United States, at least from my perspective and what I've seen, I grew up in the Bible Belt. I live in Texas now. I think that it is one-sided in that we see the Jewish state of Israel as being right. Like it, you know, you have a little segment in your book where you talk about Mike Pence visiting and having this, you know, giving this speech inside of Israel. And I think it's because it's not only that we view it as kind of a binary of, you know, good and evil or right and wrong, but it is that the negative sides of that aren't personified for us at all. And we don't see the humanity of anything else. I mean, I don't remember. It's not quite I was today years old, but it's been the last couple of years when I'm like, oh dear, the land wasn't, I'm just throwing this out there. It was like, oh dear, the land wasn't empty when Israel came. Wait, what? This is not a narrative that, now, granted, I didn't do my own research to know that, right? But in kind of the broader narrative that I think is the common narrative, I might say, or a common narrative inside of the United States, is the Mark Twain narrative. It was a wasteland. It was nothing. It was no man'sville. And it's a shame that the Shoah brought immigrant Israeli or, you know, Jewish immigrants to this land, but now they're here and they farmed it and they've made it beautiful and God has made it beautiful. And that was it. And it was kind of like, wow, this was so, you can see how predestined this was, or you can see how miraculous this was. And I'm not discounting those things in whole, but at the same time, I say there were people there. And what do we do about that fact all of these decades later?
Mm-hmm. It was actually a motto of the Jewish Zionist people, the Jewish Zionist movement. The motto was a land without a people for a people without a land. And, you know, I think one of the things that most people don't understand about the establishment of the state of Israel is that Israel was in the process of being established long before World War II. Most people think that Israel was established as a refuge for the Jewish people after World War II. And of course, it didn't become an official state until 1948, but the process of the State of Israel being established, you know, was during the British Mandate period from 1917. And really the nationalist movement to have it be established started in the late 19th century. So the history is much more comprehensive. And I think it's really important also, as we look at the history, one of the things I love to do for churches is to come in and do, you know, I can do it in as short as an hour, but I love to take, you know, half a day and just look at the history from a multi-narrative perspective. What's the narrative of the Palestinians? What's the narrative, you know, of the Jewish people in the establishment of the State of Israel? And I think it's really, really helpful to look at that. And then also to understand that when Israel was established, the rest of the world didn't want the Jews. You know, it wasn't that America supported the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 because we believed in Israel. It was because we were anti-Semitic. Let's just be clear. You know, and I think in that regard, it's not just a single narrative. We have to understand all these different nuances and realities that were happening, you know, more than 100 years ago.
Right, because we turned Jewish people who were fleeing their homelands away.
That's right.
At our borders. Yeah, we did. And that is also part of the, you're exactly right. That is also part of the history that I don't know. I mean, I feel like a lot of times that the history, because of our proximity and time to it, becomes sanitized or romanticized or simplified. And depending upon your narrative, it becomes those things in different ways. And so that's definitely part of it. But thank you for doing that, because as we shared before I started, before we started recording, my family, my husband and I have been to Israel multiple times. I mean, probably half a dozen, I guess maybe six or seven times for me, but it's been 9 years since I've been. But I will say, in all of the times that I've been, and I had wonderful experiences and I had great leadership taking me, but I have never been physically to a lot of the places that you talk about in your book. I've never physically been to anywhere where are, you know, inside the occupied territories. I've never been anywhere inside of any of those places. And so it's not that I haven't been necessarily taught about that. It's just, we know it's a very different experience. You can be taught about something, and then when you go or you experience or you speak with someone for whom this is their life, it makes a big difference in how you view, in how you view that. So in what ways, since we're kind of using that as a bit of a stepping stool, I want you to, I don't know, maybe pick one of the areas from your book that that you feel like this relates to, and maybe just kind of talk about that, really valuing a multi-narrative approach when we're looking at justice and how we can be advocates.
Well, I love what you said a few minutes ago when we were talking about Israel. You know, and you said it's not just about perspectives of good and evil, but it's actually about people. And I think in that regard, I was thinking as we've been talking, why is it a liability that I love the Palestinian people? And it is. I mean, you know, I often say, like, you don't want to know all of the names I've been called. And I'm not just talking about in conversation. I'm talking about, like, articles, you know? And, you know, I think in that regard, for those of us who choose to follow Jesus or, you know, come from a Christian perspective, when Jesus says, you know, love your neighbor, that I think actually for us to view people who are different as our neighbor and not even our enemy, like, because Jesus says, not only should you love your neighbor, you should love your enemy. And I think a lot of people would look at Israel, Palestine and say, well, the Palestinians are the enemy, you know. And what's interesting is when you meet a high school student in Palestine, the number one thing that they say is, I'm not a terrorist. Like, they want you to know. And when you meet these little, you know, not little, I don't mean, sorry to be, that's the wrong term. But when you meet kids, you know, when you meet students in high school, you know, they hate math just the way our high school kids hate math. I mean, they like the same music. I mean, they're kids, right? Like, they're these incredible young people, you know, and yet there's this global perception of othering, you know, where they are identified in a certain way. And yet when you meet, so many people, you know, Palestinian, you know, Muslim, you know, Palestinian Christian, you know, and I would say the same thing about the Jewish people too, you know, that when you meet people, most people have something in common where mothers want to raise their kids in peace. And, you know, I know that's a real issue in the US right now in terms of COVID. There's a lot of parenting going on with our schools being closed. And so you said, how does this kind of translate, you know, to other issues? And I think one of the things that breaks my heart about our political divides in our country right now is how we make it about ideology instead of making it about people. And, you know, I live on a little island off of the coast of the Pacific Northwest, and Washington State is, you know, has a tendency to be very Democrat. But there's a number of people in the community who are ardent supporters of, you know, are Republican. And on my island, like, one of our favorite things to do every week is to read the local paper, because it's things like, you know, did the chicken die when the chicken crossed the road? I mean, and I'm really not exaggerating. I was playing tennis a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, the big news was the woman I was playing tennis with had a chicken egg, you know, in her pocket, and it broke. And it was like, really, you know, I mean, like, I love living on this island because it's just so incredible. The people are so incredible. But the divisions around politics, you know, when you read in the newspaper, people are stealing political signs. You know, there's actually been conflict around, you know, these political divisions in our country. And I think that they're very symbolic of what's happening across the nation. And what breaks my heart is the way the different sides talk about each other. They talk about them like they're not people. I mean, and I work, you know, in an organization that is nonpartisan, Churches for Middle East Peace, and we work with whoever's in the White House. And I can tell you there are some incredible people in this administration who love Jesus and who believe they're doing the best thing for our country. So let's not vilify whatever side you're on, you know, the people that are on the other side. And I think that's true in Israel and Palestine, and that's true in the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. So my husband and I try to take an evening walk in the evenings now after dinner. And so our kids are kind of at that age where it's like, okay, you have access to us. We're going to go around the block, you know? And it's been really nice. And so of course we do, like many other married couples do probably, and good friends, is we solve the problems of the world on our evening walks. And it's fine. That's just what we do. And we were on a walk not long ago, and I told my husband, so I don't have the letters behind my name, but I joke, you know, I have one master's that happens to be with a concentration in social justice, and then I'm getting my MDiv right now. So I tell my husband, I'm like, okay, so as this beginning seminary student who has no authority to say anything like this, if someone asked me in one sentence, sum up what's happening right now, specifically with this Christian political divide. And I said almost exactly what you said. So it kind of makes me feel good, actually. But I said, I think that what we're seeing is what happens when people put their doctrine above their neighbor. And I think it's kind of as simple as that. And I think that's what we're seeing. And I think you're right. I think you're 100% right. And I think it's difficult because when I look at it, and I've been reading the Gospels a lot lately, and when I look at it, I think, gee whiz, wow, we're Pharisees. You know, I just think this is exactly what they did. You know, this is exactly the kind of thing, when the Bible is very clear that Jesus knew what they were doing because he could read their thoughts and their emotions and their hearts behind it. And they would say, in order to trick him, they did this. They just wanted to see what he would say. So they brought so-and-so to him. And he surprised them every time, that I can tell. He surprised them because he put the people over their doctrine. Seemingly, no matter what their doctrine was, he ended up to surprise them almost every time by putting the people first. And I just think, what if we could actually do that? Like, put the people first and not say, even with the woman who was caught in the act of adultery, and we all say, with a loud resound, but where's the man? And we say, you know, but we're not going to discount the complicated nature of sin or anything like that, but he put her first and then instructed her in righteousness. And I just think, what would happen, you know, if we were able to do that in this day?
I love how concisely, you know, I can use a lot of words, and you in one sentence said, you know, here's the core of the issue, which I think is, I think there's a lot of truth to that, you know, putting doctrine over people. And one of the threats, I guess, in that regard is the big concern from a lot of justice-oriented movements is that if we set aside our ideology, we'll be compromising on issues of justice. And I actually think the exact opposite is the truth. If we put people first, we'll become more aware of systemic injustice and then be able to address them. So one of the things we talk about with the Middle East, which directly applies here, is not only having a multi-narrative approach, but at the same time holding intention. What's it mean to have a multi-narrative approach without compromising on addressing issues of justice? And so we talk about human rights and access to, you know, economic and humanitarian resources. And a lot of times people say, well, that's you're contradicting yourself, right? You're focusing on, you know, human rights, but you're saying you're multi-narrative. And just because we're multi-narrative doesn't mean we're not addressing real issues. And so I think that whole idea of doctrine and people is that being people-focused or people-centric and not allowing, you know, focus on the doctrine while ignoring the humanity of people, that doesn't mean that we're not addressing real issues that affect people. And, you know, I think that's actually really critical. And I think it's something the church really needs to be able to hold in tension, is that both can be true. We can address real issues and, you know, love our neighbor, which my husband and I are studying the book of Acts together. And one of the things we've been talking about is how revolutionary the church was in terms of sharing what they had in common. They didn't just share what they had in common with people who looked like them. You know, I mean, just the revolutionary nature of Jesus in proclaiming himself, you know, to the woman at the well, you know, as a Samaritan woman. Like this, you know, what if we just even had Republicans and Democrats who love Jesus sit down and have meals together and have real conversation? I mean, that's actually, you know, something that's not happening very much right now. And so thank you for that. I think that that's a really good articulation of some of our core issues.
Yeah, no, I'm curious. Thank you for kind of helping me shape that and give some more language to it and kind of affirming what I'd kind of been feeling in my heart. Might be true. And let's just talk about dinner. You know, let's talk about that, you know, kind of that idea of just sitting down and having dinner, because I think that that is something that also gets lost inside of this conversation. So I think that there are maybe kinds of a couple of things. So there's might be some people in a camp who would say, well, I am cordial with my neighbor and she doesn't look like me. And so maybe it's too brash, but for the simplicity's sake, I'm not really part of the problem because I can live and breathe and be next to this person and be cordial with my neighbor. And so that's really what it's about, is we have to do this. And then maybe there's some people who might say, well, the neighboring really isn't the issue. It's the system. It's the systems that are the issue. And if we don't address anything on a systemic level, then, you know, nothing is ever going to happen. But again, I think it's one of those, it's like, yeah, but doesn't it have to be both? Like, doesn't it have to be sitting down for dinner, having the conversations with our neighbors and doing things on a personal level and addressing the systemic issues? And then I feel like, okay, that feels really overwhelming. How do we do that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that you're right, that it is both and as we're talking, you know, there was that classic book, it came out more than a decade ago, maybe even 20 years ago. The book, Divided by Faith, Are you familiar with that book?
Yeah, I actually was almost going to fill that in. I'm like, I wonder if he's talking about Divided by Faith. Yes. It's on my list, but I haven't read it. I'm going to write it down again.
So Divided by Faith is still incredibly relevant because it actually looks at the church, the white church and the black church, the historic African-American church, and the way that both kind of look at what's the gospel and what's the answer to this question. And part of, you know, it was written by sociologists. And so it's scientifically, you know, has a lot of evidence in substantiating their claims. But one of the things that they found was many white Christians look at addressing problems on an individual level, not only personal piety and personal righteousness, but really about individual relationships. Whereas in the African-American community, it's much more community-centric, but also addressing systemic issues. And, you know, as we've been talking, you know, I could hear people in my mind saying, oh, they're just so idealistic, or, oh, you know, we haven't said some hard words. Like, we haven't talked about white supremacy, and we haven't talked about white privilege, and we haven't talked about power. And I think the power differential and power dynamics has to also be another, you know, ingredient we put in the pie. Because, you know, having relationships where there's such significant power differentials also really shapes the nature of, you know, how constructive those relationships can be. And so I don't want people to hear me say it's just about having a meal, but I think that if we're really going to dismantle systems of injustice, you know, we talk about this in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We've been very, very close to having political agreements at various points in history. And the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the most studied conflict of our day. Like, you know, there's been the most books written about it. It's been going on for decades. You know, this conflict, it's not that people don't know what the answer could be, but what happens if we get a political agreement to this conflict and the people don't know one another, and the people have been living, you know, on two different sides, literally, of a wall. And children today in Palestine only meet a couple of types of Jewish people. They meet soldiers who are Jewish or settlers who are Jewish. So the relational aspect can't be ignored, because we could have a systemic peace that's a political peace with two people that still hate one another because they haven't known one another for decades. And so I think that's a really good example of how sitting around the table, particularly with people who are different from us, is a critical part of developing relationships, understanding people who are different from us. And it has to be done in this larger context of understanding power differentials and where there's privilege.
Can you talk about the power more?
Well, I think, you know, the word white supremacy is a word that's really loaded, and yet I think is an inherent in our society. And I'm a white woman, you know, and if I didn't articulate that, I would be missing, you know, I would be lacking integrity in this conversation. And, you know, what I mean by that is not some of what we're seeing in the news in terms of white extremists, you know, because I think that there is certainly a manifestation of white militias and, you know, this physical manifestation. But white supremacy has been an inherent principle in the history of our country, where whiteness has been esteemed both in terms of the investment of money, but also in terms of opportunity. So, you know, many people don't know in the 1930s in the United States had fittest family contests, where families would go to county fairs and the family that was the most white would win awards because of the esteeming of whiteness. And there's a new book out right now actually about Nazi Germany, where a lot of Hitler's programs, you know, initially were modeled after eugenics programs that we had here in the United States. And this is a history that's insidious. I mean, Lord have mercy and forgive us, you know, that this is something that even if here we are decades later and we could say, well, you know, my family didn't own slaves, or I'm not guilty of that. And yet we've inherited it, you know, because it's a part of the history of the establishment of our country.
Yeah. So, thank you, because I'm not afraid to talk about white supremacy. Earlier this summer, my dad and I were having a conversation and he said, "Alexis, you keep saying racism. I think what you mean to say is white supremacy." And he kind of called me out, and I'll admit, I mean, my dad is white. My mom is Mexican American. I married a white man, and all of this made me feel very uncomfortable. and I think it should, I'll just say that. I think it should. But I also think we should get over it and talk about it and talk about and learn the history. I don't mean just like, you know, we'll build a bridge and get over it. I mean, like, let's learn the history. Let's have this conversation. And so if you don't mind, I'll say two things from my experience that were recent where I just thought, go ahead. Were you going to say something else?
Well, just as you said history, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, go for it. Go for it.
One of the books I had the privilege of co-writing is a book called Forgive Us, Confessions of a Compromised Faith. And I have my PhD in history. One of the other authors had a PhD in history. We wrote it with Lisa Sharon Harper, Soon Chan Ra. The other historian is Troy Jackson and myself. And we looked at the history of these different issues. And then the second part of each chapter is a call to repentance for what we've inherited from the history. And so I just am echoing when you say we have to understand the history. I fundamentally believe that to be true. Let's look at the past. There's an African word called Sankofa. That means look at the past in order to be able to heal and move forward constructively into the future. And so if that's a resource, you know, I think that that's a really helpful project to understand the history in order to be able to repent of what we've inherited today.
Oh, no, I'm gonna put that link in here as well, because those names that you were able to co-author with, I'm like, yes, those people that you listed specifically, they're speaking this language, right? Of understanding and lamenting and asking forgiveness, right? And going through this, because it isn't just, you know, I say, well, we need to get over it. It's not just get over it. We have to do these things though. We have to understand, we have to seek to understand, and we have to, go through that process. I completely agree with you. And so thank you for that. No, I was just going to mention, just give it an example from my own experience. So I grew up in Oklahoma, and time just escapes me right now. I don't even know what year it came out, but Latosha Morrison's book, Be the Bridge, I think. I bought that like when it came out, and she has a lot of wonderful examples and talks about history in that book quite a bit. And she talked about the Tulsa massacre. And I'm like, whoa, 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 Tulsa? Wait a minute. And so I'm like, you know, at the time I'm reading this book in my late 30s, sitting on my couch wondering how on earth I went through 12 years of Oklahoma state history and was never taught about something so completely horrendous. I mean, never. And something so important to our history. I was dumbfounded, just completely dumbfounded. And the other one was slightly less dramatic for me, but equally as traumatic, I feel like. But I was actually getting ready. I was prepping for an interview I had with Mark Charles. And I, again, kind of reflecting on growing up in Oklahoma. And of course, he's of Navajo heritage. But I was thinking the language that I had grown up with was the five civilized tribes. That was the language I was taught in Oklahoma. And I stopped. Again, like this was this year, right? And I'm like, five civilized tribes. And I had to go take a walk. I was like, this is blowing my mind. Like, this is the language. This isn't the language that was there 100 years ago, right? This is the language that I, as a 30-something-year-old person, grew up with in my history classes in Oklahoma. And it's probably not just Oklahoma, right? Probably kids, U.S. history, you know, when they do their unit on Native American studies or whatever it might look like, might even have used similar language. But just that idea and how steeped in white supremacy that idea is, that these particular groups of people were civilized. Well, what made them civilized? Do you really want me to tell you what they deemed civilized at that point, right? And just how very, very steeped that language is in white supremacy, how very steeped our history is in white supremacy, that I could go through that many years and not have heard about the Tulsa Race Massacre. This is real, and it's something that we have to reckon with.
That's right.
So that's all. That's all. May, what would you tell us as we start to wrap up here? What would you tell us right now? I mean, we're at the end of 2020, but when this airs and people listen to it, it's not as if COVID will have gone away. It's not as if all of us will be feeling all of a sudden refreshed from the wake of 2020 that we're living in. And so what would you tell us of kind of this idea of, I hear you and I see the hashtags, but I'm worn out.
Hmm.
I can't think about it.
I love, I told you this before we started recording as well. I love the language you use related to your podcast about generosity, and particularly generosity and justice. And I think, you know, at this moment for all of us, we need to be generous with ourselves. I mean, the cost of, you know, being isolated from family, not being able to travel, you know, many people losing their jobs, you know, the financial stress, the stress of, you know, loved ones being sick and not being able to see them. I had a tragedy in my family this year that was just devastating. My brother, who's was almost 13 years younger than I, died in May. And I had to fly home and bury him. And the people that buried him, you know, were neighbors who were isolating with my mother. It wasn't even the people that love him most. My husband wasn't by my side. And the toll of that on our souls, I think we can't measure. And so when I hear you talk about generosity, I do think we need to not give up the fight of being advocates for justice, but may we also be gracious with ourselves and gracious with one another.
Thank you. I'm so sorry, May. I didn't know, but
thank you.
I'm so sorry. And I appreciate you comforting others with the comfort with which you have been comforted by the Holy Spirit. That's really meaningful. And it's a testament to the community that we're talking about and and the kind of thing that we're trying to encourage in each other. So thank you for sharing that. And thank you for continuing and for more than just the reminder that we do need to be generous with ourselves, because Jesus is generous with us.
That he is.
I often think about the scripture, I think from Hebrews, where the writer says he is not ashamed to be called our God. And I think, well, this is part of what makes him other. Mm-hmm. Because there are definitely times in almost every day of mine when I think, I might be ashamed to be called her God, mm-hmm. but he doesn't view us that way, and he is generous with us. And I think you're exactly right that we can be generous with ourselves in that way, and generous with each other too. So thank you for that. Is there anything that you just say, oh, if she had only asked this, it would have given me the opportunity to say something else. Is there anything that you want to say to us as we wrap up that you feel like maybe we missed?
You know, as we're closing, talking a bit about grief and some of the challenges personally, but also challenges that we're going through, you know, as a nation and as the world, the thought that comes to mind is just, And I'm not saying this in any way tritely, you know, we pray regularly the Lord's Prayer, and we pray thy kingdom come. And one of the things that's just been comforting to my soul this year is that Christ's kingdom is not yet here, and yet one day it will fully come. And so this comfort, you know, people say to me all the time, they'll ask about different aspects of my family life. And my response will be, that will not be redeemed on this side of heaven. It will not be made right. It is a brokenness. You know, my brother's death is just one example. It is a complete tragedy. And yet God is good. And, you know, the verse that you just quoted, that God is proud to be called our Father, and yet God's kingdom will completely one day reign. And so the reminder that this is not the end of the story while we're on this journey, at least for me, sometimes, you know, helps me stay in the game and to continue to be present and to continue to engage.
Thank you so much for that, May. We want to, I'll link all of this, but we want to connect with you and your, the organizations that you help with and read your book. Where can we find all of that?
Great. Yes. Thank you for asking. So my, hashtags are not hashtags, my Twitter handles and all of that are all the same. It's just my full name, May Elise, Cannon, and May is M-A-E. And my website is maycannon.com. So it's all kind of at that place. And the organization is Churches for Middle East Peace. And so that's just www.cmep.org.
Awesome. Well, I will put that. No one has to like pull over and write that down. I'll put it in the show notes and make it links for everyone to click on those and connect with May. Thank you so much. This has been a real encouragement to me, and your book was incredibly helpful. I just want to throw it out there and say this really, I kept wanting to call this the handbook, but you have a handbook, but this felt a lot like a handbook. This, it really did, because at the end of every chapter, May has additional resources. If you're like her and you suffer from insomnia and just have to read something, she's got books at the end of every chapter that you can read, and organizational websites and places where you really can get connected. If something just pricks your mind or your heart and you think, I really want to be active in that space, particularly May has resources for you inside of this book. So it's Beyond Hashtag Activism, Comprehensive Justice in a Complicated Age, and I will link it. Thank you so much, May.
Thank you for having me.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.